From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Why. I'm Annette John Hall.
When I think of the Delaware River, I'm normally just thinking about it as where the waterfront is, so where a lot of the nice stuff in Camden is, and in Philadelphia, like Penn's Landing.
We love the Race Street Pier, and of course, Spruce Street Harbor Park is a lot of fun.
Next time you're on the banks of the Delaware River taking in one of the new parks that have popped up in recent years, maybe visiting the Seaport Museum or just walking along Penn's Landing, think about this. None of it would have been possible without the help of the Clean Water Act. 50 years ago, the Delaware River was considered a dead river.
The main pollutant that really led to these dead rivers was raw sewage.
That's right. Back then, the Delaware River was full of raw sewage. The river stank and fish couldn't live there. But through a concerted cleanup effort brought on by the Clean Water Act, things turned around. Now, as the federal government attempts to roll back some environmental regulations, it's worth reexamining why the river got much cleaner and what could happen if it's not protected in the future. Today's show, Keeping the River Rolling. In their series, Reviving the River, WHYY's Susan Phillips and Dana Bate looked into how the Clean Water Act helped turn the river into what it is today. So guys, take us back to the river before the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972. I didn't live here then, and I bet a lot of people listening might not remember what it was like.
It stank, Annette.
There were no fish.
The hulls of ships would turn black.
There was a pilot who claimed he could smell it from the sky.
It was a dead river.
So we did actually find a group of people, some retired fishermen, who did remember what the river was like in the 50s and the 40s. So I met one guy, Ron Soto, and he talked about what he remembers.
I'm 80 now, so, you know, so I was a little boy at the time, and my memory of it was that it didn't smell good and it didn't look good.
So how did the river get so bad?
Essentially, we were dumping raw sewage into the river. We were also putting, you know, slaughterhouse waste, which includes blood, guts, I mean, all that gross stuff. And Dana went to the Temple Archives and she found all these photos of this environmental degradation.
And, you know, because of all that, there were no fish. So when I talked to Soto, he would go out with his grandfather who had a tugboat and he would ride along. And he talked about, as a kid, he was maybe 10 years old, what that was like and what he would talk with his grandfather about.
I said, how's the fishing here in the river when I'd be on this tugboat? And he'd say, there's no fish. I said, why not? He said, well, there's an oxygen barrier in the water and there's no oxygen here. Consequently, the fish can't live.
So what did he mean by oxygen barrier?
Fish need oxygen to breathe just like we do.
Right.
They breathe it through their gills. But what happens is when you've got a lot of bacteria as a result of all the sewage, all the slaughterhouse waste, chemicals that were being dumped into the river, the bacteria gobbles up all the oxygen and leaves nothing left for the fish to breathe.
So it's hard to imagine the river was that awful. When you go to the river today, you just don't see any evidence of that.
You're right. I mean, you go to the river today and you see Spruce Harbor Park and ferry boats and, you know, yoga is happening on the river and beer gardens and $500,000 condos are being built along the river. But at that time, it was primarily industry. And if anyone lived near the river, they weren't very affluent.
What happened?
People got fed up. You know, it wasn't just fishermen. It was a national movement. Huh. People were sick of having a dirty environment, and there was this building movement for change. So, yeah, we talked to Richard Pepino, who worked at the EPA for about 25 years, and, you know, what was going on at that time that brought about this huge, massive change?
People just didn't want dirty air and dirty water. My mom we lived in West Philadelphia. She used to hang out her sheets. And when she went to pick them up at the end of the day, she was ticked off because they had soot on them. And my mother and my father were not really environmental activists, but they wanted the environment clean.
And then, Annette, you know, in 1969, something unbelievable happened.
The Cuyahoga River in Ohio is so loaded with the waste products of petroleum distillation that it is actually in danger of catching fire.
A river caught fire. One could hardly imagine a scenario when a river caught fire. And many people think that was the turning event that forced the Congress to take very serious action with both the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act.
That was the Cuyahoga River in Ohio, and it wasn't the first time it caught fire, but for some reason, this really, like, set the movement in motion. It was, you know, images were on TV, and that helped the grassroots movement then force Congress to then pass the Clean Water Act in 1972.
What happened then?
The Clean Water Act really provided a carrot and stick, and it was a bipartisan effort. And the reason it was carrot and stick is because it set these regulations and rules, but it also provided money, federal dollars, for these municipalities to clean up the sewage treatment plants, because the main pollutant that really led to these dead rivers was raw sewage. And, you know, Rich Pepino has a interesting perspective of what was going on then, because he was a young guy who just came out of grad school and one of the first people to work for the EPA, because remember, we didn't have the EPA until these major laws were passed back in the early 1970s.
Here's Felley sitting at that time with two major wastewater treatment plants that just frankly weren't very good. And along comes the federal government with this big check and says, we'll let you upgrade these, which is the thing that gives us this today.
So how much did all this cost?
In Philadelphia, it cost about $900 million. Nationally, it was more than $1 trillion to upgrade sewage treatment.
And, you know, we took a tour of one of those treatment plants to find out, well, okay, what happened here? And we're out with the current water commissioner, Deb McCarty. She started working there in the early 1980s as an engineer. But while we were on the tour, she explained what was happening in the 1940s.
When it was first installed, that old pumping station pumped right to the river.
Like, what actually, was it raw sewage going into
yeah.
the river?
Yeah. Yes.
There was no treatment.
So the guy you're hearing there, that was Bob Serpenti, and he was in charge of that plant at the time of the Clean Water Act. And he was on the tour with us, and he was a really interesting guy because he gave us this perspective of the before and after. He explained to us how once the Clean Water Act passed, he really had to do things on the fly. I mean, there were no computers, there were no calculators.
We had a small crew of young engineers and old mechanics and operators, and we just threw ourselves at it. It was amazing.
The Clean Water Act ushered in a new age of biological science when it came to sewage treatment. Before that, what they did was essentially use gravity. So the sewage came in, the solids settled to the bottom, the scum and the grease went on the top, they scraped that off, they took the solids from the bottom, they put them into lagoons out by the airport where they still are.
Now you're turning my stomach, Susan.
Okay, well, they're still out there.
They're monitored. They're monitored, but they are still there.
So we know that better sewage treatment made the river healthier for people. But what did this process do for the wildlife?
Fish are back, right?
Lots of fish are back, you know, and that's what's so amazing. And, you know, recently they found that the sturgeon, in fact, is spawning in the Delaware River.
And the fisherman I talked to said this last season was the best shad run he remembers ever seeing on the Delaware. And he can catch walleye, likes catching bass, there's stripers, there's all sorts of things. He regularly fishes exclusively the Delaware.
But this doesn't mean that everything is wonderful, right? I mean, you also looked at emerging pollutants. What are they?
They're basically things in the water that we can measure, But just because we can measure them doesn't mean we always understand the impacts on public health or even on the environment. So there are things like plastics, microplastics, pharmaceuticals, perfluorinated alkyls, PFAS, chemicals that we can now detect, but we don't always know the impacts of.
So how does the Clean Water Act address those pollutants?
It doesn't. And it hasn't been amended or updated since 1987. And that's what worries people like Rich Pepino.
I got an 1987 telephone I want to sell to you. You want that? But yet we try to manage today's problems with a law that hasn't been changed since 1987.
In the age of climate change, what are some of the new threats facing the river?
There's also the issue of this combined sewer system that we have in Philadelphia, where our sewage and stormwater basically go through the same system. So if we get a super heavy storm, which there are more of those predicted as the planet warms, a lot of that, if a sewage treatment plant can't take all that, if it's too much water, too much volume, they just discharge what they can't take into the waterways. That means more sewage will be going back into the river when we've gotten so far in cleaning it up.
What are some of the ways that these problems are going to be dealt with?
A lot of people we talked to, you know, what was happening in the 70s and the 60s leading up to that, there was a real collective grassroots movement, both in figuring out what the problems were that need to be solved to address the problems and then to create that solution to improve the river and the waterways around the country. And right now, there isn't even necessarily the will to figure out what the problems are that we need to address first, much less find a solution for those problems.
Susan Dana, thanks so much for coming in, and thanks so much for the fascinating science lesson.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
You can find the whole Reviving the River series at whyy.org/river. And that's it for the show. The Why is produced by me and Shai Benyako, along with Alex Stern and Kelsey Hansen. We had editorial direction from Katie Colinari. Subscribe to the podcast and don't forget to leave a review. Got a comment? Reach out at AnnetteJH, at Shai Benyako, or at Alex Ray Stern. We'll be back tomorrow.